Today we look at H.R. 1. It's comprehensive legislation that could dramatically impact your right to vote. Welcome to Culture Shift, the Barry Ferris Show. We are living in an American culture that has shifted from tolerant to cancel culture, from decent to rude, from optimistic to cynical, and from relatively safe to increasingly violent. But it's not too late. I hope to equip you with a historical framework applied to current events so you can lead and get America back on track for good. Hey, welcome back to the Barry Ferris Show, Culture Shift, where we care about your success, and that depends on your freedom. Today, we're going to look at H.R. 1 and discuss its impact on your freedom. You know, George Orwell describes in his book, Politics and the English Language, how the more destructive, dishonest, and indefensible a policy is, the more likely it is to be described in language that obscures and hides its purpose. And that is certainly the case with H.R. 1. It's called the For the People Act of 2021, and that title couldn't be less accurate or more misleading. H.R. 1 was initially passed in 2019 by the House after the Dems took the majority in 2018. And at that time, even the ACLU published an official letter opposing the bill. The ACLU said it was too restrictive against free speech and the right to assemble. Then it died in the Senate. Now it's back. H.R. 1 restructures the Federal Election Commission to a partisan majority rule campaign regulatory agency, and it creates extensive new restrictions on freedom of speech during campaigns and much more. It just recently passed the House again, 220 to 210. No Republicans voted for it. One Democrat voted against it. We don't know what's going to happen in the Senate. It's 50-50 with the Democrats owning the tie-breaking majority. Thankfully, Senate rules allow the bill to get tied up, and currently the filibuster is still in play. There are procedures which cause the process to slow down. For example, a senator can do what one did, and that is demand that the entire almost 800-page bill be read from the Senate floor. But let's look at what the proponents say. The proponents, the advocates of this bill, argue that it'll make it possible for everyone to vote. They claim that it removes partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts. They claim that it brings more transparency to campaign finance. The reality is it makes it easier for underage voters to vote. Underage voters are defined as voters who are under the age of 18. H.R. 1 implements a nationwide voter registration of 16 to 17-year-olds with minimal screening qualifications. Over 65,000 underage votes were cast and counted in the 2020 election cycle in Georgia alone. That was before H.R. 1. So H.R. 1 does some things that bring voters into play that shouldn't be. For example, dead voters and voters who no longer live in the state should obviously not have their vote counted. H.R. 1 actually restricts the ability of states to clean their voter rolls. In fact, it makes it harder to purge the rolls of deceased voters and voters who have moved out of the state. It does nothing to curb the wait and see how many votes I need process. One of the reasons the votes were required to be submitted by 9 p.m. in Florida, or explain to a judge why they couldn't do what every other county did, was to block the wait and see how many votes I need process that had happened so many times down in the Miami-Dade County area. And that process strengthened election integrity. H.R. 1 compels states to send out absentee or mail-in ballots universally. This opens the door for vote dishonesty. It allows states to count ballots that arrive by mail as late as 10 days after the election. And it does nothing to discard returned mail ballots that arrive after Election Day. It also does nothing to eliminate absentee ballots that are cast without the statutorily required application. It does nothing to discard absentee ballots that were cast prior to the statutory deadline. In fact, it makes those illegal votes easier to accept. It does nothing to discard votes from absentee ballots that were cast after the statutory deadline. In fact, it makes it easier for those illegal votes to be accepted. It does nothing to discard votes from absentee ballots that were returned on or before the postmark date. That shuffle is just not honest. Yet, H.R. 1 makes it easier to accept such a suspicious vote. It makes it almost impossible to discard votes from absentee ballots that are cast from an address other than where the voter legally resides. It makes it hard to discard votes from absentee ballots without a postmark. These suspicious votes shouldn't count. H.R. 1 actually legalizes ballot harvesting. This is a practice many states are struggling to stop. Here's how that works. a political organization pays a worker to walk through a housing project or a neighborhood, knock on doors, offer to help residents fill out the ballots that they've received in the mail, and then submit the piles of completed ballots all at once. It's a recipe for paid activists to throw away the ballots from homes they believe are Republicans and keep the ones that are Democrats. It also opens the door to enter the home with a gift and help the voter with a Democrat vote before taking the ballot and checking it and sealing it for the voter. You know, maybe John Adams' argument that in order for a republic to last, voters should display some sense of personal responsibility goes too far, but H.R. 1 goes in the opposite direction. H.R. 1 makes it hard to discard absentee ballots which were received without the voter requesting the ballot at all. In fact, H.R. 1 makes it almost impossible to even know if the absentee ballot was received without the voter requesting the ballot. It makes it impossible to discard votes from absentee ballots where the mail-in ballots were cast by voters who didn't register by the registration deadline. H.R. 1 opens the door for an undefined process. It makes it impossible to discard a vote where the voter has no address on file. In fact, anyone who goes to a DMV or applies for food stamps or Medicaid or other social services or attends a public college will be automatically enrolled to vote, whether they want to be or not, and whether they've got a current address or not. It makes it difficult to discard votes by non-citizens. It eliminates that normal voter identification process. In fact, Section 1015D2 of H.R. 1 makes it illegal for any government official to make a record of or to disclose publicly an individual's decision not to affirm his or her citizenship. That's a quote. In other words, you can state that you're a non-citizen and still vote. It makes it difficult to discard a vote that does not have a voter registration number, which corresponds to the voter. It makes it difficult to discard a non-registered voter. It makes it difficult to discard out-of-state voters. In fact, the national laws, rules, and guidance blurs state lines, in addition to being totally unconstitutional. It does nothing to stem poll observer abuses. It does nothing to verify that the voter has a matching signature. In fact, it bans state voter ID requirements. Anyone can show up on election day to vote, registered or not, and simply sign a statement that they are a legal voter. H.R. 1 is being sold as a reform to make voting easier. Yeah. In truth, it makes cheating easier. It makes it nearly impossible to determine if a voter initiated the vote from a county other than where he or she is registered. It allows felons to vote. It will remove from the individual states their constitutional authority to establish election laws and rules. You know, there's a reason the Constitution does not allow the feds to take over elections. In fact, the authors of the Constitution worried that Congress would try to seize control of presidential selection using tricks like these in H.R. 1. That's why the founders acted to take the business of voting as far as possible out of the hands of the feds. And that's according to the founders. In fact, when describing Article 2, Section 1, one of the founders, Charles Pinckney, a framer from South Carolina, stated that Congress had no right to meddle in the national election. Only state legislatures would have the power to determine how the president is chosen. No national rules. The Constitution says it's up to the state. There's a reason for this. It brings local accountability. I mean, the closest you can get to the actual people on the street is a state legislator. It takes it out of the hands of the feds. The whole idea of states' rights is to preserve a republic, giving states kind of equal power to the feds. A centralized approach, though, to voting will actually weaken the republic. The idea of a republic is to prevent a full-bore democracy. In fact, total democracy allows you to do very onerous things when it comes to buying votes. Witness the $1.9 trillion bill where only 9% goes to COVID relief. The rest goes to direct payments to union voters and fixing Democratic state pensions, etc. But back to the Constitution. It has what is called the Times, Places, and Manner Clause. That's Article 1, Section 4, Clause 1. And this Times, Places, and Manners Clause basically states that those things, the times, manner, and places, the manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. The clause empowers states to regulate the details of congressional elections, including drawing districts, setting registration, voting, and counting procedures, deciding whether there's going to be a runoff, and fixing the day for voting. H.R. 1 is a direct attack on this, completely removes all that power from the state. This is constitutional power that the state is supposed to preserve. Why are they motivated to do this? Well, they can't control the states. And though it's not always been the case, the states are currently mostly run by Republican legislatures at this time. H.R. 1 also has an impact on the U.S. Constitution. In Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, where the state legislatures have the power over presidential electors. Here's what it says. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. The legislature may choose electors itself. It may prescribe how the people elect them. It may even dictate how electors vote. The legislator doesn't share this authority with anyone else, not even the governor. This authority keeps the feds as far away as possible as the founders demanded. H.R. 1 erodes this state authority. Another U.S. constitutional provision that limits somewhat the legislature's power in presidential elections is called the Same Day or Presidential Vote Clause, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 4. It reads that the Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. Everybody's got to do it on the same day. It reduces the amount of fraud. This was put in place to make it harder to wait and see how many votes you need to win. It's designed to require each county to submit blind the results of the election in each location. But when a county or a state can hold off for days waiting on the other counties or states, that opens the door for all kinds of Republican votes to get lost and Democrat votes to be created. It could be vice versa, but that's been the trend. Back to H.R. 1. The current House Minority Leader of the Republican Party, Kevin McCarthy, says that this H.R. 1 is really for the Democrats to use their razor-thin margin not to pass bills to earn voters' trust, but to ensure they don't lose more seats in the next election. And that certainly seems to be the goal of H.R. 1. There's a reason there are currently 200 bills in 43 states which would shore up some of the vulnerabilities in the election process. These are Republican-initiated bills. Things don't happen simultaneously like that for no reason. Democrats want to cram H.R. 1 through. It severely limits the state's authority to clean up voter registrations. Some states are new to voting by mail. In those states, H.R. 1 allows people to vote early with an absentee ballot without any reason. Those states require a reason right now. What else does H.R. 1 do? Well, it paves the way to make the District of Columbia, D.C., into the 51st state. What does this have to do with making every vote possible? Well, that would hand Democrats two more Senate seats, breaking the current 50-50 tie. You know, voter registration in D.C. is 76% Democrat and only 6% Republican. The founders were clear. The entire district's a unique federal district of the United States. It's really the seat of the federal government. The District of Columbia operates under Article 1 of the United States Constitution and the District of Columbia Home Rule Act. It serves a unique role. It's the seat of the federal government. It can't be a fair state at the same time. And the city has become way too corrupt and way too financially dependent on federal government to be the 51st state. D.C. has no vital industry except lobbying and bureaucracy. Compare that to a small state similar population to like Wyoming. It's got workers in mining, logging, agriculture, manufacturing, and logistics. H.R. 1 has no respect for Article 1 of the United States Constitution. The 23rd Amendment of 1960 gave D.C. 3 electoral votes. So that mutes any argument that D.C. citizens can't vote for the president. They already do. H.R. 1 would also require undoing that 23rd Amendment. Amendments to the United States Constitution require bipartisan support. They're hard to get done. H.R. 1 tries to do an end run around an amendment to the Constitution by changing the status and the parameters, not only of all the things we just talked about with voting, but with the District of Columbia at the same time, without an amendment. The Federalist Papers were a series of articles that are published in the New York paper to argue for ratifying the United States Constitution. So to maximize their argument and eliminate any personal opinions people may have had against the authors, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay signed their editorials under the name Publius. They wanted to hide and shield their identity to increase the odds that the arguments would be just looked at without regard to who the authors were. The opposite of trying to get your name on a piece of legislation is what they were looking at. They just wanted the best ideas to win this argument. They didn't want the bias or the historic idiosyncrasies of any of the individuals that were making the argument to get in the way. It was truly an amazing feat. It changed everything. The articles convinced New York and other states that were previously opposed to the Constitution to ratify the U.S. Constitution. Americans today deserve the same freedom, whether they're making their case through a pen name or donating money to a political cause. The Supreme Court of the United States has upheld this concept in 2010 ruling, Citizens United, and it was made on the basis of free speech. The First Amendment matters. It prohibits the government from restricting independent expenditures for political communications by corporations, including nonprofit corporations, labor unions, and other associations. But H.R. 1 changes that. H.R. 1 would expose supporters of conservative causes to disclosure and harassment, just like in 2013, President Barack Obama tried to bully people by using the IRS to strong-arm tax-exempt Tea Party organizations into disclosing their donors. H.R. 1 uses this thuggish tactic with the force of law, requiring organizations to disclose their donors. H.R. 1 attempts with a club to stifle conservative voices. So who supports H.R. 1? Well, that kind of tells you something. A huge coalition of far left-wing nonprofit activist foundations, teachers' unions, industrial unions, racial equity activism organizations, pro-abortion groups, trial attorney associations, and environmentalists. There's not one Republican in favor of it. The huge H.R. 1 measure was rushed through the House with minimal committee hearings or markups. The bills supported outside Congress were drawn mainly from progressive nonprofit advocacy groups, Democrat campaign activists, labor unions, environmentalists, and Silicon Valley corporations. The final tally in the House showed 220 Democrats voting for the passage, which is just one Democrat actually voted against it. All 210 Republicans who voted opposed the proposal. There were two Republicans that didn't vote. There's currently three vacant seats in the House. So opponents of the measure outside of Congress include the National Disability Rights Network that worries about the increased use of paper ballots, a coalition of 130 nonprofits that oppose being forced to disclose the names of donors, 16 secretaries of states and counting, and other state election administration officials, and 9 former FEC commissioners. Historically, the FEC is bipartisan. With H.R. 1, it changes that to a majority party rule. That almost assures that if Democrats are the majority, they get to control how the FEC conducts its business. It basically takes aspects of California's disastrous voting system and projects it onto every state. If you're not already convinced that H.R. 1 is really bad, since it makes federal laws out of many of the most controversial 2020 election dishonesty issues, and since it attacks Americans' First Amendment rights to free speech, how about this? H.R. 1 would launder corporate dollars through the U.S. Treasury and use those dollars to publicly fund congressional campaigns. And it allows members of Congress to draw an additional commission from campaign funds to boost their salary. I mean, let's say a corporation wants something from congressmen and he makes a really big donation to get it. Currently, the law doesn't allow members of Congress to spend that donation on themselves. In theory, that limits the ability to be bribed into a one-sided policy. But H.R. 1 allows them to take money from that donation and pay it to themselves. That's in addition to the salary and benefits and operating allowance they already get. I mean, that has enormous potential to create conflicts of interest. I mean, you think D.C. is corrupt now? I mean, let's just hope and pray H.R. 1 doesn't pass. When we say the Pledge of Allegiance, it's to the Republic for which it stands. The Founding Fathers wrote the U.S. Constitution with a clear view that the United States is a republic. Alexander Hamilton and James Madison made this explicit in the Federal Papers. They said the federal government will be made up of elected officials who represent the will of the people. In fact, most of the United States founders believed that a direct democracy would result in nothing more than, and I quote, instability, injustice, and confusion. As a result, the United States Constitution outlines a system of government that allows people to vote fairly on representatives, and then those representatives make law in accordance with the people's will. Each of the state's governments are set up in the same way. H.R. 1 dissolves the mechanisms contained in the U.S. Constitution which preserve our republic. So if you do not want Congress to become even more tone-deaf by catering to only wealthy donors so they can increase their own pay, and if you want to donate to a cause without being exposed, bullied, and potentially fined, canceled or doxxed, and if you do not want D.C. to illegally become a state, and if you don't want to have the bipartisan FEC become a partisan weapon, and if you do not want to lose the U.S. Constitution's election process, that is the only hope for preserving our republic, and you don't want dishonest elections, you should call your senator and tell him that you don't think he should vote yes. He should vote no on H.R. 1.
Hi, I'm David Farah. Thank you for listening to my dad's podcast, The Barry Farah Show, Culture Shift. Click subscribe now to be sure you don't miss an episode. Share this podcast with your friends on social media and give The Barry Farah Show your 5-star rating. Check out today's show notes below this episode and at TheBarryFarahShow.com. This podcast is also available in video format at The Barry Farah Show on YouTube. See you next time.